listening to the Central Station Podcast, where we bring you true stories of what life in the outback is really like and why many wouldn't live anywhere else. So pull up a stump, pop the billy on, or crack a cold one as we talk to the men and women who call some of the most remote parts of Australia home.
Paddy Heatley had a fairly unconventional childhood. By the time he left home at the age of 9, he'd already dropped out of school, foregoing learning to read and write. At the age of 12, he was smuggling tobacco, alcohol and cattle from South to North Island. And at the age of 16, with his mother's signature forged, he climbed aboard a ship bound for Australia. In this episode, Paddy shares yarns from his early days in Ireland and his first few years in Australia. He speaks about meeting his future bride, the time he was almost charged with attempted murder, his days working with, and sometimes walking on, crocodiles, and settling in the Northern Territory as a cattle truck driver. Paddy sure has lived life to the fullest. And as you can imagine, there was no way we could fit his whole story into one episode. So keep your ears out for more in the coming months.
I was probably what you'd call a proper mongrel. I was the odd one out of 11. I was known as a black sheep. I didn't mix with the rest of the family. They tried all sorts of things on me, but it never worked. I wouldn't go to school, which I never did. And sort of that was it. I was just an adder. I wouldn't say I had no respect, but I pulled out from home. I left home. I camped around the district. I worked for different farmers.
So how old were you when you left home?
I was, I think, 9, 10.
9 years old when you left home?
Yeah.
And you were you were one of 11 children?
One of 11. I was the second youngest of the boys. And I wouldn't say I was mistreated at home, but because of my size, everything I got the blame for. And it sort of wore on me what I was, and I'd stayed with an uncle for quite a while, and I'd done a bit of work for him. He was a merchant navy seaman, and I looked after his place. I lived there. If I didn't want to go to school, I didn't go to school. I went down and worked for other farmers in the neighborhood, picking potatoes, carrots, onions, you name it, we done it.
So if you left home around the age of 9 or 10 and stopped going to school, how has that affected your ability to read and write?
I sort of never worried about it. It was a thing that probably never entered my mind at the time. I thought afterwards, if I had been educated, I would have been dangerous. And I carried on doing that. I would see my mum every now and again and talk to her, and always wanting me to come home.
So once you leave home, you said you spent some time working with your uncles. What else did you do after that?
I'd met a fellow with machinery. Used to do a lot of hay work, making hay. And we'd do a few trips down over to the south of Ireland, and we'd bring a bit of contraband back with us. A lot of whiskey come back, a lot of cigarettes come back, and we managed to make, a few dollars or pounds in them days it was.
So you were effectively smuggling whiskey and tobacco across the border from South Island to North Island?
Yeah, yes.
How did you smuggle it?
We used to carry it across the fields. We'd go down in a motor car and buy it and then we'd come back so far and get out and carry it around the fields, and the car would go through the border and pick us up on the other side, and away we'd go.
Did you have, you know, how much did you have on you? Were you wearing like a big jacket that was just, you know, twice its size because it was just stuffed full of tobacco?
No, or? we carried it back in crates.
So you had to get out and walk across the field like holding a big crate?
Oh, holding a crate. We'd carry three crates back with us and probably 500-600 cigarettes, packets of cigarettes. Cigarettes in the south of Ireland in them days, you'd be paying about two bob, which is Australia 20 cents today, and a bottle of whiskey, like a 40-ounce bottle of whiskey, you'd buy for a pound. But in the north, you'd be getting a pound for a packet of cigarettes, and you'd probably be getting 10 pound for a bottle of whiskey.
Wow. And did you ever get caught, or were there any close calls where you thought you were going to get caught?
There was probably a few close calls, but we were probably young and too quick for the fellows what were doing it, like looking after the borders.
Well, talk about young. You were like, what, 11, 12 years old?
12-year-old.
They probably weren't looking at you walking across the field thinking that small child has got all this contraband.
Well, it wasn't. We weren't small fellows. Like, I was 6 foot something when I was 12-year-old.
Wow.
And the fellows with me were nearly the same. And we were ready for, you know, a run. There was no worries about that. We knew the country pretty well. And we just carried on. We wouldn't do it regularly, on a regular basis. We'd go when it suited us, and there wasn't much suspicion that we could bring it back to the local pubs, which we knew, and they would buy it, no dramas. We'd just, you know, carry on with it. Then we got tangled up with a few of the old fellows that used to buy cattle in the south of Ireland. And they could go down and buy them at the furs, as they would call them, as we call them markets here. Well, they called them furs over there. And they might buy 8 or 9 cows, and they'd load them on a truck, and they'd bring them back so far to a farm, they would unload them, and then we'd walk them through the fields to the other side of the border, and the truck would pull up at another farm, and we'd load them back up and bring them back over into the north.
So if the farmer had purchased the cattle, why all this hoo-ha of unloading them and sneaking them across the border?
Well, you had to pay, like, your duties on them.
Oh, taxes.
Taxes okay. on them. And everything in the south of Ireland was a lot cheaper than the north of Ireland, because it was free government run, is where the north is controlled by the British. And they were after every dollar they could get, and we were after our dollar. We just, you know, we carried on with that for quite a long time.
So at the age of, you know, 11, 12, you're becoming an old hand in smuggling. Smuggling tobacco, alcohol, cattle, whatever it is, across the border from South to North Island.
That's right. We done it, I think it was 14 when I sort of finished doing it, and then I started thinking about what else I could do. And then the idea of Australia come up and America come up, and I wanted to go to sea when I was young, because my father was a seaman, and the family wouldn't let me. It was probably one of the reasons I turned on them. They wouldn't let me because he was drowned at sea, and they didn't want the same happening to me.
How do you get to Australia, though? Because even though you'd been out of home for several years, you were, what, 14, 15, you were still legally a minor.
Well, I got hold. if a mob in Belfast by the name of the Big Brother Movement, and they sponsored people like me to get jobs and to leave home, because work in them days in Ireland and even England was pretty fragile. So I got the paperwork, and I had a sister, and I talked to her about doing the paperwork for me, which she done, and she had signed me mother's signature on the paperwork so we could get it. Oh, it was probably a month after we had done it, they'd sent a letter to the sister, and she had come and seen me and said, look, you've been accepted to go to Australia. So I kicked my heels up and said, bloody good. My mother and her sister come to, we got on the boat in Belfast. We went from Belfast to London to Liverpool docks. And my mother and sister come with me to see me off. And they said, oh, you'll be back in 12 months. And I said, no, I won't. And they spent a night with me in Liverpool, in London. And I got on the boat and I waved goodbye, and that was the end of it. I said goodbye and that was it. No more.
So if your sister had to forge your mother's signature, I thought that meant that your mum didn't know you were going. But at some point, did you have to go and tell her?
They knew I was going, but she wouldn't sign the papers.
So then, and then once she found out you'd been accepted, and obviously something had happened, like her signature being forged, she didn't try and stop you or put a stop to it?
No, she didn't. I think she probably wanted to see the end of me.
Oh, I'm sure she didn't. She probably just knew it was like trying to, you know, catch the wind, you know.
Yeah. I had my own money. She used to say, Paddy, you'll never be broke, because wherever you go, your pockets jingle. And she was probably right. I always had money in my pockets. And I had been saving for this particular thing. I'd saved £360.
That sounds like a lot of money. How much would that be in today's money, do you think?
Oh, be probably $800-900, Australian dollars.
That's a lot of money.
And I'd made my mind up well and truly that I was leaving.
Tell me about the trip from Ireland to Australia. How long did you spend at sea?
Well, I was four weeks and 4 days on the boat, and I had a really good time. I'd seen a lot of countries. I'd been to a lot of countries and spent a lot of money and drank a lot of beer and met a lot of people. We got to Sydney. We left the boat there. We were there probably at Sydney Harbour for half a day before we were picked up. And we were all taken to a farm at Parramatta. The Big Brother Movement had a training farm there.
Your first job was with a man called Huey Hannan. Tell me about him.
Well, Huey was a journalist during the last war, 1945, when it finished, or when it started. My first appearance of him, he was a pretty frightening man, well-spoken man, spoke loud, very strict. And he come and picked me up, and the first thing was he said to me, he said, do you drink? I said, yeah. I said, I do have a beer. So he went to the pub and he got a beer. And we're driving home and having a beer and a yarn. He said, do you know a bit about milking cows? And I said, yes. I said, I've milked quite a few cows in my day, which I was young then. probably the worst thing I'd done was saying that. He had 300 of them. And we get back to the farm, and the accommodation wasn't the greatest. We'd a busted ass old caravan to camp in. His wife done the cooking. She was probably a bit of an old dragon, but we got on all right with her. And every night you'd go for tea after you milked the cows, you'd have a beer for you. You'd get a long neck. And you were fed. That was one thing. The food was always on the table waiting for you. We'd sit out in the kitchen, have our tea, and then go. You'd get up in the morning, 5 o'clock start, have a bit of breakfast, go and milk cows. We were still milking cows at 10 o'clock in the morning. We had modern, was modern gear in them days. We had a milk tanker come in and pick the milk up. Then we had to clean the dairy out, pump the milk into the tanker, wash the vat.
So after 3 years of working for Huey, you decided to leave. What was behind that decision?
Huey was a generous man, very generous man. I had a lot of time for him. And he had a fair bit of time for me too, because I think I was just a slave to him. But it worked out all right. Him and I argued and fought and carried on, but it was good. I think I just had enough. I needed a change, and I decided to go. I thought milking cows, if I'd have stayed, I maybe could have done some good. I don't know. But I decided to take off and have a look around the country and see what else there was to offer.
Well, I guess it was a pretty good decision that you made, because it was during this time that you met your future wife, Maureen.
Yeah, well, I'd worked for a little fella in Finley on a bulldozer, and we'd gone into the pub there, and I'd seen this girl in there working behind the bar. She was only young, but that didn't matter.
That sounds terrible, Paddy. But how old were you at the time?
I think it was 18, 17, okay. 18, something like that. In them days, I didn't keep track of my age. It just, every day was another day, another year, another year. And I'd said to this bloke I was with, I said, Jesus Christ, that's not a bad looking sort there, you know. Well, we'd gone back to work, we'd had a few beers and gone back to work. And he said, I can fix you up a date with her if you want to. He said, my friend knows her pretty well. His girlfriend knew her very well. I said, yeah, all right, that'll do. So
you didn't even ask her out yourself.
No,
you got someone else to do it for you.
I had, but she wouldn't come to the party.
So tell me about the first time you spoke to her and what you said.
Oh, well, we had a bit of a yarn over the bar and sort of softening her up a bit. And I said, would you like to go out one night when I'm not working? And no, I can't. I can't leave the place. Can't. She was the barmaid and looking after kids. And she wasn't allowed, put it that way. Probably underage, I think. So I said to Kenny, hey, Jesus Christ, you know. Yeah, and he reckoned to me, he said, well, I'll fix you up the date, and which he done. He said, we'll make it a double one. He said, we'll go to the pictures in Deniliquin, which is another 20, 30K up the road, a little town called Deniliquin, and we'd pulled up at the pub. Well, the bloke at the pub had known me, and the owners of the pub had known me. And they knew I was a bit wild sort of a bloke, which they were right, but it don't matter. And this girl come out and got in, and we sort of met each other pretty well that night, talked and yarned and carried on. And We didn't have any beer that night. We stayed sober. We'd gone to the pictures and come home, and I'd dropped Maureen back off at the pub. Said, well, we'll catch up with you again. Well, I think the fantasy maybe had sort of set into my head then of that girl, I got to see her again. So I'd asked her, went back and asked her, but she wouldn't come out with me by herself. So I said to Kenny, I said, you'll have to see if she'll come out with Denise and you again with it for us. Several times that had to happen before she would eventually come by herself.
Well, according to Maureen, it was 8 months before she would go out alone with you.
Yeah, that's about right.
Well, you must have wore her down eventually, because after 2 years you guys got married and headed off on a big adventure.
We had a Falcon ute and two dogs, and we left Finlay. And I said, well, it's probably a place I will never come back to, or like back to work or out of it. And we went down through South Australia and we got out on the Nullarbor. Well, back in them days, the Nullarbor was a pretty desert sort of place, arid country. So we got to Cocklebitty and it was sort of dark, and I said, we'll pull up for the night. We couldn't make it to Norseman. I said, we'll pull up here for the night and camp the night, and then in daylight we'll go to Norseman, Kalgoorlie. And we'd got in the back of the ute, we'd made up a bloody swag there and had a bit of tucker to eat, give the dogs a drink of water and a bit of feed, lay down and went to sleep, and we woke up in the morning and blow me dead, we're in the middle of a rubbish dump. So that was a good honeymoon, waking up in a rubbish dump. So we straightened ourselves up a bit and had a bit of a wash and got going, and we hit Kalgoorlie. I wanted to work in the gold mines, and we couldn't get accommodation. Kalgoorlie in them days were booming. A lot of work going on, really going ahead. Maureen had been talking to some people from a place called Balladonia, and they owned a station and the pub there. And they'd told her to go back to Norseman and see the people at the garage, a bloke by the name of Larry Harcott. We went back, pulled in, and the bloke said, you can start now, straight away. He said, oh, we'll have to go and find somewhere to live first. He said, you found a place right now. He said, there's a place over the road. He said, you can have $3 a week rent. He said, Paddy, he said, you can go to the mines. He said, and you'll get a start there straight away.
It was pretty easy to get a job and a place to live back in those days by the sounds of it.
Real easy. Real easy. Nobody wanted to work then either.
So Norseman was where you guys had your start, but it wasn't until you moved on to another town that you actually bought your first truck, was it?
No, that's right. Yeah, we moved to, I sort of got the shits one day and said we were leaving, which I done. We packed up, sold what we could sell. We'd got a bit of gear by then. Loaded Maureen and the dogs and away we went in the ute. Got lost around Perth, but we made it till Carnarvon, and I'd pulled in and seen a bloke on the way into Carnarvon about work, and he said no, but he said, if you go and see a bloke by the name of Seth Rodley at the mobile depot, fuel depot, he said he might be able to fix you up with work. So we did, before we even got a place to stay. We done the produce at night time, then daytime we carted a lot of fuel and fresh water to the salt mines, Taxada, Cape Cuvier. In them days, they were kicking off. They had no water there. So we done that. Then at different times we'd go up the highway north to stations. We'd cart fuel, wool back. Different times fuel up and bring kangaroos back. They had a kangaroo abattoir in Carnarvon. Maureen had a cleaning job, and she used to come with me at night time. She was my offsider then at night. And we'd pick up produce, beans and bananas and you name it, everything. And I dropped her off back at the caravan park, and I'd kept going to the yards where we offloaded. And I'd been gone for quite a long time, like quite a few days, pretty flat out. And I'd got in there, and this bloke that used to do the inspecting of the loads, he started to give me a hard time. And I wasn't in the mood that day. I was, you know, boiled over, probably you would say. So I grabbed hold of him and I give him a bit of a shake and a bit of a choke, and I said, "I'm sick of you, you bastard, you know." I said, "You're not harming me." I said, "You're harming all these other poor bastards on the river." So things, it blew over that day. I went back home and I was having a sleep. And the next morning, the coppers come to the door. "Paddy Heatley." I said, "Yeah, that's me." He said, "You better come with us." I said, "Got a few questions to ask you." I said, "Oh, yeah. What about?" He said, "Oh," he said, "you give a bloke a bit of a choke," and I said, "you nearly killed him." I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, what's the charge?" He said, "Oh, attempted murder." I said, "What?" I said, "Bloody bullshit." I said, "All I done was choke the bastard." Shook him up and shook him. So they took me to the police station, and I sort of knew a few of the police there, and they knew me. And at the end of the story, the old sergeant come out and he said, "Jesus Christ," he says, "Paddy, you're lucky." He said, "You know, that bastard had a heart attack. And that's what happened to him." He said, "You can go home now." So away I went.
So did he have a heart attack and die?
No, he's dead alive.
He did? What was it? You said he was inspecting the loads that you were bringing. What was it that he was inspecting that had got you so angry?
Well, they used to cut the bags of the beans open. The beans were all put in bags, Hessian bags, and sewed up. And then they'd cut them. And we had to sew them back together. Well, I was getting pretty shitty about it. Well, we had to tie them or do something because you couldn't load them on the big trucks, open bags. And I said, "There's nothing wrong with the beans or the capsicums or ever what it was." Like, wooden crates of bananas in them days were in wooden crates, and they'd prise the nails out of the tops of the boxes and take the bananas out. Well, then they'd be left on your truck. So we had to nail them back down again or sew the bags up and get rid of them. So it sort of, I was getting sick of it, because it wasn't happening just once in a blue moon. This was happening nearly every day. And the other blokes were getting sick of it. And the farmers were getting sick of it, so I thought I'd take a stand on it. And that's what I done. I took a stand on it, and I said, "I'm not having it. This is, you know, instead of us unloading and going, we were there for hours. It wasn't one or two bags. Sometimes he'd open 20 bags up just to have a look at the beans to see if there were ever what was in them." And it got to me, and I done what I had to do. And I'd explained all that to the police, and they said, "Oh, well, we can see your point there." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "But I didn't, I only shook them and joked them." I said, Jesus Christ, when that old sergeant said, he said he had a heart attack after it. And I said, "Well, that's not my problem, is it?" I said, "I didn't know he had a crook heart."
Oh, my gosh, Paddy. And how old you would have been? What, if you were 19 when you got married, you've been 20, 21?
21, 22 or something like that.
Oh my gosh. Hadn't even been in Australia 10 years yet. You're already trying to get an attempted murder charge laid on you. My goodness. So, not, you know, after Carnarvon, you ended up way up in the north of Western Australia in Wyndham.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, I talked to Jack Wainwright about road train driving. And Jack had said his brother owned EKT, East Kimberley Transports, in Wyndham. He said, when you go up, you go and see Bob. And he said, you'll get a job there for sure. He said, they're always looking for drivers. So EKT was on the left-hand side of Wyndham as you went in, big yard, blue and white crates, trucks. And I pulled straight in and went into the office. Bob Wainwright. He said, yeah. I said, I'm Paddy Heatley. I just come from Carnarvon, and I was talking to your brother. I've had a bit to do with your brother, Jack, over the last 12 months. And he said, there'd be a possibility of me getting a job driving a truck. I had my own little body truck there. And he said, well, he said, Jesus, he said, you've hit us at the wrong time. He said, it's off, the season's finished. It's no work now. He said, but later on, when things start again, there'll be plenty of work. I said to him, I said, is there anywhere else you reckon I could get a job? And he said, yeah, go down the road about 2K it was. Maybe not even that. And he said, you'll see a big shed there. He said, bloke in there, Hugo Osler. Tropical Road Construction. Done road works and station work. He said, he's always looking for blokes.
Tell me about the first time you went out to a cattle station.
Well, that was Carlton Hill. And Carlton Hill in them days, it was a pretty well-known spot. And L.J. Hooker's owned it. And we'd gone out there to do a lot of road work and dam sinking, cleaning dams out. And I was amazed when I actually got out into the open country along the Ord River, what it was like. I reckon, Jesus Christ, this is the best thing that ever happened to me out on a place like this. Hugo, he'd come and go. Maureen was in the camp. She'd done a bit of cooking at different times for us. Then with another old fella in the camp was the cook, but Georgie was sort of half blind. And he had a bit of a mishap one night cooking. And it had a cat in the camp. And he thought the cat was sitting on top of the gas stove. Well, George put his hand over to pick the cat up. The cat wasn't there, but the flame burnt all his hand.
Oh.
So Maureen finished up the cook in the camp. And Diego said, I've got to go and look at a crocodile. He said, do you just want to come? We'd gone with him to look for this crocodile. Diego was a pretty famous icon as a crocodile man, done a lot of crocodiles hunting, shooting, and we'd gone with him. But as time went past, I think there was more crocodile hunting going on than there was roadworks and stuff. And we'd been sinking a dam or cleaning an old dam out, and the dozer had front idler had packed up on it. And we'd got down in the bottom of this dam and we'd jacked it up. And we were there probably 2-3 days working on this machine, getting this idler out of it. And then Hugo had to go to Wyndham, then do the same on another old dozer to get an idler out of it. And he was away for a few days, and we carried on with other bits of grading work and different things we done. We detoured a couple of creeks and just general earth moving work, cart and gravel. Then Hugo returned with the idler, and we're down in that thing, probably there for another 2 days, maybe more, trying to replace this idler. And we eventually got it placed, got the track back on it, and right, everybody standing back, righto, boys, we're ready to fire now. I can still see Hugo today. I had a bloke on the dozer. He cranked her up, reversed up the bank a bit, and then come in with the blade down, and God damn me dead, at the other end come the big croc. The croc had buried itself in the mud, and we'd been working onto that bastard all the time and pushed him out over the top of the bank. Well, Hugo, old Hugo reckoned, well, he said, that bastard will pay for this job, won't it? So he took care of that. And then he used to say at night time, we'll go down to the river for a swim. The old crossing, there was a back road. What used to go around the back of Carlton Hill, and you'd come out on the Wyndham Road. You'd cross the odd river. Well, we'd go down there and we're having a swim and wash up in the river. And Maureen spotted all these eyes. Well, she said, what are them? Old Hugo said, they're crocodiles. Well, Maureen left the water and never went back in it again. But
did you didn't know that there were crocodiles in the water?
No, we didn't have a clue. We were sort of pretty naive about that them things in them days.
Oh my gosh. And how did you feel once you found out that you'd been, how long had you been, because I think Maureen told me another time that you guys had actually been bathing in that water for several weeks.
Quite a long time, yeah. Yeah. I sort of knew about it, but I never used to say anything to them about it.
But you still went in there yourself?
Yeah, yeah.
Paddy, why?
Oh, well, just one of them things, I suppose. He didn't worry about things like that. But, he used to say, going out to catch a few crocs tonight, do you want to come with us? And we'd say, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we'd get the boat and away we'd go, and we'd put it in down in some of the creeks on the station, like salt, what you'd say, salt arms out of the odd river. And we'd get out, and he used to say, now you two have to get out and push this boat, no?
Get out and push it on on dry land or?
No, in the water.
He wanted you to get out of the boat in the water.
Yeah.
And push the boat.
Push the boat.
In the water that's full of crocodiles.
Yep. So you made no noise. The idea, if you had an engine, outboard motor made noise and you wouldn't. We caught these crocs alive, not shoot them or anything. They were caught alive. So you could push, see them. You'd have that spotlight on them and you'd be there pushing that boat up to them and you'd push alongside them. And he'd put his hand out and catch hold of them and bring them into the boat. Then he'd tie them up, put the tape around their mouths and tie their front legs back.
Did you ever worry that the crocodile would catch you before Hugo could catch the crocodile?
Well, it was probably one of them things like your adrenaline runs, so you don't worry about it.
How do you not worry about it, Paddy? Walking in croc-infested waters.
Well,
like,
I don't really know, but I think by then there wasn't as many as there used to be. But occasionally you'd put your foot on them because they'd be laying on the bottom of the water.
So you just step on a crocodile.
You'd just put your foot, and then as soon as you knew you'd done that, you'd be in that boat real quick.
Did one ever kind of pop up to say hello and say, excuse me, you just stepped on me?
No, we never had that occasion to happen, but we had one night got a bit loose in the boat, took a bit of cordialing with us. But
one got loose in the boat?
Got loose in the boat, yeah. But we managed to control it. we were pretty right that way.
What kind of boat are we talking about? Like, is it like a tinny or
just,
something?
Just a tinny, yeah. About a 14-foot tinny. There was four of us in the boat. Maureen was with us.
No wonder you're married after all these years. Jeez.
Oh, it was excitement. It was worth it. It was an adventure. And it was something I wouldn't do it for a living, but I liked it. It, as I say, like your blood got running and it was quite good. It was quite interesting.
Sounds like it was a bit of a novelty.
Novelty, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you never wanted to follow in Hugo's footsteps?
No, no, no. It, I guess it was like smuggling cattle or smuggling whiskey. It was one of them things, and that's what we were doing. It was all in them days on the black market done. And after that, well, you couldn't really do it because it's tied up too much, but you couldn't do it. And now it's out of control. So I don't really know what else you could say about it, to be honest.
It's just amazing that you're still here to tell the tale, to be honest. I mean, first of all, you're bathing in croc-infested waters and then you're out. I love it. You said, you know, you cut the engine, so if you're quiet, not to disturb the crocodiles. Meanwhile, you're stepping on a few of them. I would think that the noise, if anything, would, yeah, I guess that would alert them to your presence and they might swim away. But I would think that surely wouldn't they feel like smell you in the water or your body temperature or something to, I just can't believe that nothing came out and had a snack on you.
No, no. The only time I ever had a go, one have a go at me was at Scott Creek.
In the Territory.
In the Northern Territory, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And then I woke up to myself how dangerous they were. And it come out of the blue at me, and maybe I did have two heart attacks that day. I don't know, but by Jesus Christ, I learned a lot afterwards.
Oh, my gosh, Paddy. Mm. Oh, my gosh. So you seem to be enjoying your time up in the Kimberley and somehow surviving it, God knows how, but you ended up in the Northern Territory. How did that happen?
Well, probably we wanted to have kids, and Maureen couldn't get pregnant, so we had to go to Darwin to see what was going on, why, and she had to have some treatment. But it was only supposed to be a day trip, and we'd got there all right, but we were there for a week, and I sort of said to her, I said, Jesus Christ, I like this place up here. And I made it home. I said, we'll stay here. I had to go back to Wyndham, pick the truck up, pick a load of gear up, which we'd accumulated over a period of time. We had a ute, caravan, which sort of started to get ahead a little bit, and Maureen come back and we picked the ute up. We'd run into a lady in Darwin who had sort of took us in and looked after us a bit for a while, well-known person, Mavis Waddell. Mavis was an Aboriginal woman, come from over the west, over Broome, and knew a lot of people, and sort of helped us out a great deal. We picked our gear up in Wyndham, come back, and we looked around. I got a job. Maureen had went and got her, was doing trips back and forth to the hospital in them days. And I'd got a job with John Holland Constructions on machinery.
What was it like for you up in Darwin and even Wyndham the environment up here is really different to where you'd come from in Ireland and everywhere else you'd been in Australia. How you said, you know, you got to Darwin and it felt like home. It couldn't be more different from your original home of Ireland, well, though.
The atmosphere and the people was good.
Did you ever struggle with the actual atmosphere, though, the heat and the humidity?
We did for a while, but as time went on, we grew out of it. We had no air conditioners. In the caravan, we had no air conditioner. We used to wet a blanket, a sheet at night, put the sheet on the bed and turn the fan on, and that was our air condition. We lived quite well through it. I think we did anyway. It didn't really worry me, but it got to Maureen a few times, and I think eventually we did get an air conditioner, but Jesus, it was a long time afterwards.
Gosh, the things Maureen's put up with, you know, a honeymoon and a dump and an attempted murder charge and going out, you know, bathing with crocodiles. The least you could do is get the woman an air conditioner.
Well, things were pretty tight in them days.
And it was only a couple of years after moving to Darwin that you guys welcomed your first child. So the fertility treatments worked.
Yeah.
I didn't, to be honest, I didn't even realise that that was something that you could do back in, this was the 70s.
Yep.
I didn't even realise there was options for fertility treatments back then. So you started your family. Tell me about that.
Well, I was pretty busy by then. I was running up and down the roads in trucks and doing a lot of cattle work. And Maureen said one night, she said, I got to go to hospital. Well, I said, well, I got to go and pick a load of cattle up at the Circle T at the 11 mile belonged to Ray Townsend to take back to Stapledon Station. So I loaded her up in the prime mover. I took her to the Darwin Hospital and I took her in and dropped her off and I said, I'll see you in a couple of days' time.
Did she have to go to the hospital because she was having a baby?
Having a baby, yeah.
Paddy, you didn't go with her.
No.
You didn't stay with her.
Couldn't in them days.
What? What do you mean?
Well, I was just too busy and I didn't know a lot of people up here then. You could do anything like to help. So we had talked about it. We had worked it out. She reckoned she'd be right. And I said, well, are you sure? She said, yep. So I dropped her off. And I think it was 2, maybe 3 days later, I gets a call and said, I'm ready to come home. Oh, Jesus Christ. So I'd gone in. I hadn't seen her since I dropped her off. I hadn't seen the baby. And I said, look, I said, I can only take you home. I said, I can't stay. I've got a load of cattle on this truck. So I was in the prime mover and I picked her up, put the baby in with her. And I'd got back out to the 11 mile to the rodeo grounds. And another bloke there by the name of Dean Groudon had a truck as well. Dean and I were sort of buddies in the business. And I said, I'll pick the trailer up, load the bulls up, and I'll go in home at Humpty Doo. We had a place at Humpty Doo in them days. And I'll drop Maureen off, and I'll meet you out at the station. So I'd taken this baby in, and this baby had clicky hips. Clicky hips. She had a bar between her legs to keep her legs. So you could put your arm around her neck and grab her by the and carry her in. So I carried her in and done everything what I had to do to so she was right. But Maureen had lived with me long enough to be able to look after herself and knew what to do and how to do it. And I said goodbye. I said, I'll see you in a couple of days' time. Well, I dropped her off, took off, I'd gone back into 11 mile and hooked the trailer up and Dean had already left. And I'd gone down the road. And back in them days, the roads were a lot different than they are today. Like, all dirt roads, bad roads, they were never highly graded. And, I mean, it wasn't a big distance, but it took a long time, very slow. And I got out to Stapleton and offloaded the bulls, and old Dino said, he said, "How's Maureen going?" I said, "Oh, good. We had a little girl." And he said, "Oh, well," he said, "we better wet its head now." I said, "Yeah, righto." They pulled a bottle of rum out, and we had a couple of rums, and then we took off. And I think it was a week later when I got home again. I had a few more trips to do to get a few dollars, and I got back home about a week later.
How was that for you at that time? Obviously, you had responsibilities at work, and you wanted to make an income to support your family, but then you missed out, you know, on so much of, you know, in that first week. Was that something you thought about back then, or was it just...
Well, I probably didn't think about it in that way, because I had that to deal with, and I had my other business to deal with. And back then, things were different. Like, it's not like today. We had a nurse used to come around every week, and we had a neighbour, which Maureen and her were good mates, and they'd help each other if they needed help. Like, Maureen would go to her and she would come to Maureen for help, and we had things pretty well sorted out while all this was going on. Yeah, so it just was one of them things, I guess.
Yeah, just how it was back in the day.
Days, yeah, yeah. Things back in them days, things were a whole lot different than today. It's not running back to your mum all the time. Well, this is going on and that's going on. Well, that never happened. It just, people have changed. I guess we were brought up in the old school days. We were learnt to do what we done, and I really don't know much more than that. That's how we done it. We just carried on with it.
The birth of Jan wasn't, I guess, the only kind of new chapter in your life at that point. It also was around that time that you got your first road train, which was going to become a very big feature in your life as the children and Maureen are. Don't want to make the truck sound more important than the family. But yeah, that was I guess another new beginning for you. So tell me about this truck.
Well, I'd bought a International 160 Inter, which in them days was a pretty popular truck on the road. If you owned a 160, you were up with the top ranks type of thing. But when I bought it, I got a run out of it, and then things went bad with it. And blokes used to tell me in the early days, you never buy a green truck. And this bastard was green. And the first thing, the motor blew up. And we fought hammer and hell to get that fixed. They fixed it. And I'd done two trips in it, and it blew up again. Well, then I found out that they'd budgeted the motor up. They didn't want to spend the money on it, and they'd budgeted the motor up. So I back to them again, and we had a lot of words to be said, which there was. And I made them, it got down to the point, like there was another choking coming up. But it didn't eventuate. They decided they would do the truck up, do the motor up, and they done the motor up properly the next time. But the truck had other issues what I didn't know about, and eventually I rolled it and I burnt it, and was carting cattle out of Port Keys, plumper.
And you rolled the truck?
Yeah.
With cattle on it?
Loaded, yeah. It caught fire.
Before or after you rolled it?
No, before I rolled it. It was burning when we rolled it. And what had happened was I had a bloke with me, and he was sleeping, and it had shorted out, and I'd put my hand down to grab the wires to pull the wires out, and I'd come into a corner, and when I'd come back up again, I pulled the wheel too quick, and over she went. And there was nothing we could sort of do by then. It was burning pretty well, only get out of it. And we both of us got out of it all right. And then we were jammed in it between the crate and the prime mover. We had a load of bulls on, and one bull upped us. And we had to stay there for quite a while. But it burnt right to the cinder, right? The only thing that was left was the back wheels.
Were you able to let the bulls off?
The bulls were all off.
Okay.
They had gone.
Okay.
When it rolled, they're only single decks. And when it had rolled, the bulls escaped, never killed any.
Oh, because was it open on the top?
Open, yeah.
That's lucky at least for
them. But back in them days, there was nobody on the roads. No, there were only bush tracks we were travelling on. We had to walk 30-odd kilometres we walked, Ricky and me, Ricky Stanton. And hot, very hot sand, all sand country. One water bottle between us, one pair of thongs between us. So Ricky had walked so far on the left foot, and then we'd change over. I'd walk so far on the left foot and have the right foot change over back and forwards to keep the sun off her feet. Heat.
You were sharing a pair of thongs.
We were sharing a pair of thongs. And we walked all day, got back to the camp that night where we were coming from, and told them. I said, nothing we could do about it. I said, the bulls are out there running around. And I'd got back to town. The truck was insured, lucky, but I had to bring it to town to get it back into town before the insurance would assess it. And then I'd done all that, and I'd gone into town to Darwin, and I'd bought another truck to carry on with. The crates wasn't damaged too much. We were able to straighten that up, got it back on the road again. I put this other prime mover under it, and I drove it for quite a long time. I used it quite a long time. It was buggered when I bought it. A bloke that owned it told me, he said, it's had it. It was a Dodge. I probably drove it for 2 years or more. Never let me down. I used to carry a drum of oil on the front seat. I'd stop and check it, fill it up with oil and go. And that's all I ever done to it. And one day I decided I'd put a new motor in it. And I went to the bloke in Darwin, a Perkins dealer, and I said, how much for a new motor? And he told me, I said, how much to put it in the truck? And he told me, I said, righto. I said, have you got one here? And he said, we do. He put a new motor in it for me. And I kept going. I bought a second prime mover then.
So this was the beginning of your, I mean, you'd bought that first truck back in Carnarvon, but this kind of was the beginning of really kind of hooking into the trucking business.
Yeah, was.
Well, that seems, I guess, a good place to pull up for now, because as everyone's going to hear in part two, you have spent a lot of time in trucks. And I think that story you told us just then about rolling the truck is probably just scratching the surface of all the stories of the adventures and, shall we call them, misadventures that you've had along the way.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
So, I mean, what an incredible journey so far, from coming from Ireland and working your way around Australia, meeting your gorgeous wife along the way and somehow keeping her through all these things, I have to ask, did you ever stop and think about all that you had accomplished by this point? You know, the fact that you've come on your own and on your own two feet, not with, you know, mum and dad's money or support or an education behind you. You have everything you've got at this point, you've got on your own and with your wife, Maureen. Did you ever stop and think about what you'd achieved?
Oh, at times people have said different things to me and people have said that had doubts about me that they'd never think, like I was told I'd never do any good in life. And, well, I proved them wrong and I told them to their faces. I sort of answered them back and just said, well, what did yous do? You know, I said, I left home. I said, yous are still there.
Did you ever have any contact with your family at this point in time when you're in your early 20s and you had your trucks? Were you letting anyone back home know what you were up to?
No.
So you were 100% on your own.
100%, 120%, if you want to say 200%. I wouldn't have anything to do with them.
So looking back on this part of your life, which it feels like we've gone over decades here, but it's not even a decade that we've gone through from the age of arriving in Australia at 16 to what you must be 22 at this age, probably with these trucks, 23 maybe, if that. What would you say is the biggest lesson you learnt during that time?
Oh, Jesus. Not to trust people. Yeah, I've been burnt quite a few times. I've done it hard, but I've jumped back up again and proved them wrong as well and probably still doing it today. One lesson I have learned is don't trust any bastard, no matter who they are, you know. People say, do you trust your wife? I said, well, I suppose I have to.